Afternoon, it's 12:07. I'm Sean Beter, and this is Midday Matters on 89.1 WBOY, your home for NPR news and diverse music. Thanks so much for being with us on this Tuesday edition, and it's a Tech Tuesday edition of our program. Of course, we'll be inviting you throughout the program to join the conversation today about big data. The number to call us, it's 800-471-9264. You can always email middaymatters at nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet at Midday Matters. With me, of course, in studio, Susan Burns. And Susan, we have a heck of a show lined up today.
I think we do, Sean. It's a show that we've been sort of talking about for a while now, and wouldn't you know, it popped up in the news, so we're a little more timely than we had thought we might be. But we've got a couple of our favorite guests for Tech Tuesdays. Anthony Giuliano from the Azure Agency, where you're the VP of Marketing and Social Media. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, Susan. Hi, Sean. Hi, Bob.
And yes, Bob Niskern, who is the president of Adaptive Microware. And Bob is one of my favorite guys because he's sort of way out there on the tech topics. So glad to have you here, Bob.
Glad to be here, Susan, John, and Anthony.
And, of course, as we mentioned, we hope you'll get in touch with us as the program goes on here. We want to kind of define our terms here first. And we were talking in studio before the show got started about, you know, what is big data when we talk about this? And Anthony, you brought up a really great kind of metaphor to help explain to folks, you know, what we mean when we talk about this topic.
Sure. I think it's one of those terms that's better defined by example. And I'm a baseball fan, so I always default to the Moneyball example. If you've seen the movie Moneyball, you know that the Oakland A's looked at a new way of finding players. Instead of scouts choosing players by observation, it was looking at statistics, going back through decades of data and saying, what wins baseball games? And, you know, just to give a simple example, what they determined is that on-base percentage is as important, if not more important, than batting average, something that people had depended upon for decades. So it's interpreting data in that way, where you're looking for patterns, looking for predictability based on research, based on data. And when you consider the implications for other industries, when you consider the implications for healthcare, for example, you can see that it has a potentially profound impact on a lot of different areas of our lives.
And I see a lot of nodding and smiling over there, Bob. This sounds about right, or would you add to that?
I would add slightly. The example is a good one. The data, that sort of data and statistics collection have been done for many years, but people hadn't realized they could use it. Mm-hmm. And so the advent of more inexpensive computers, individual scouts, and some of these people involved in those sorts of decision-making, we're actually able to do some of this statistical mining, looking over this data from a sort of a fresh perspective. And I think that what we call big data today, you could argue many of the techniques have existed for years. But it is true that there is more data today than there has ever been in so many ways, many of them more informal than in the past. And there is a lot of computing power.
Bob, would you agree that what makes big data different than simple data is the complexity and the size of the amount of stuff you're dealing with?
Yes, and that's the thing. Even though it's easy to say, you know, you could have a computer at home today that's more powerful, you imagine, but the types of computing power that's used to process these truly large data sets are amazing. People like Google and Amazon have built huge facilities that go for blocks and blocks and blocks that are just filled with computers.
And not just processing power, but storage as well.
Exactly. It's just as important to store the data. I would also say that in the past, where you did refine data down for statistics that you could then deliver to someone else, keeping the raw data allows you to ask a new question in the future that may contain insights. If the data is too filtered down, it may actually not be as broadly useful in the future. So that's the ability to keep data that people in the past would have thought is noisy data or not terribly useful. Now you have cheaper storage, so let's keep it anyway.
I think over the course of this program, we'll probably focus more on companies and consumers and how this relationship continues to evolve, really, and really what consumers can do with the knowledge that they're being tracked. But, of course, the big topic in the news right now, and I imagine it will be for some time, of course, are the revelations from Edward Snowden, a former contractor, had top secret clearance as an infrastructure analyst, I believe he called himself, and the revelations that there are massive amounts of data, both phone records and online information available to the United States government. And of course, we're still hearing new things every day about this, so we can't get too deep into it. But Bob, let me ask you first about your reaction to this story. I mean, is this kind of the, I guess, a natural progression, and not necessarily whether it's right or wrong? I mean, this capability clearly exists.
It does, and I think it's very interesting to see the broader reaction to this. I mean, people in the technology community and others have understood that this sort of data could be collected. I think people didn't realize the capability, the scope of that, and the fact that, you know, under some discussion within the federal government, they have the right to look at some of this data or maintain, you know, keep it under a collection point. Maybe they don't look at it yet. Mm-hmm. But the idea that if the data went by and you never collected it, even if you did get a warrant later to try to find it, it wouldn't exist. So I think there's some proper and useful questions to answer to separate out the concept of data itself and what people do with it. And I think that's an important social topic.
Anthony, you wanted to jump in on that?
Yeah, and I think it truly represents more of an evolution than a revolution. You know, as Bob has referred to, the data collection has existed for a long time. You know, there are stories that I've heard about the FBI monitoring pizza delivery behavior to try to say, if someone is holed up and they are hiding, they're probably having food delivered. So let's look for the places where that food is being delivered, and we may have a suspect. That's, a simplified example, but it shows that these types of things have been happening for a long time. What is changed is the amount of digital breadcrumbs, so to speak, that we leave behind, and how many touch points that we're leaving these tracks that can be exploited for very good reasons or for very nefarious reasons. And what's evolving, I think, is our response to that and the structure we're going to put in place to determine what's permissible and what's not.
And I make the mention that I can recall in the past examples where people were concerned about data that the government collected and kept secret. Freedom of Information Act was put into place in 1978 to address that concern. And many very valuable things have come out for citizen discussion through requests for information that come from news agencies or if you want to see some of your back. So as long as there's processes and due process, we are a nation of due process. And I think the idea that if the data exists or it could be used for certain purposes, we should understand those purposes and have the ability under certain circumstances to appeal or you know, it's just the same years ago you could not actually see your own credit reports if that's some erroneous information that got in there could be affecting your life and you wouldn't know it. So instead of banning all credit reports, there a mechanism was put in place to allow errors to be corrected. So I would like to believe that these discussions will lead positively to the future of how we manage this data.
I think that's an excellent point. Big data is neither good nor evil. It's about how it's used. And there are tremendous possibilities. I think, you know, the problems of healthcare, the problems of climate science are only going to be resolved with the assistance of big data. But it also opens up a Pandora's box of other possibilities that we're just starting to understand, and that ground is shifting beneath our feet.
I want to talk a little more about some more specific examples in a little bit. I do want to invite our listeners, of course, to get in touch with us. We're talking about big data on this edition of Midday Matters Tech Tuesday. Call us with your questions or comments, 800-471-9264. You can always email middaymatters@nipr.fm. Post on our Facebook wall. Send us a tweet at Midday Matters. We'd love to hear from you this hour. Anthony Giuliano, as kind of a transition here, you know, as we're learning more about this NSA surveillance, it appears as though the government isn't, you know, necessarily directly tapping into, say, the backbone of the internet, but getting information from companies, and it's these companies that have really collected all of this data on, as you mentioned, these digital breadcrumbs on us. So there's this kind of uneasy relationship there, I suppose, but also this relationship where we, you know, ordinary folks are willfully giving this data, really, to folks like Google, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera.
Well, absolutely. Every time you sign up for Facebook, every time you start a Gmail account, every time you make a credit card purchase, you are volunteering information. Now, the fact of the matter is, it's hard to live in our society today and not do some of those things. But we have to understand what our responsibility is. And if there's a problem with this, it's going to be resolved. It's going to be resolved by all of us collectively setting some limitations, as Bob suggests, and really insisting that there be rules put in place to determine what people can do with this information. But again, it's let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's some great possibilities here. One of the areas, Sean, where there's the most controversy is in the marketing area. The degree to which marketers are trying to make the spend of their dollars more, get a higher return on investment, and to assume predictability in consumer behavior. And again, this is something that's been going on for a long time. We were talking about this before the show, but when you have a Gmail account, Gmail is interpreting the emails you send to deliver you more relevant ads. That's been going on for a decade. The question is that an intrusion on your privacy? Do you want better advertising content, more relevant content delivered? Well, do the two go hand in hand? And how do you separate what's good about that and what is not so good about that?
Looks like we have a caller on the line here. And of course, that number one more time, if you'd like to get in touch, is 800-471-9264. Let's open the phones here and go to Elena. Elena, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call. Several of your commentators have made comments that the majority of Americans didn't realize that this sort of data collection was available. But George Orwell wrote about it in 1984, and several other science fiction writers wrote about it long before that. And I'm very, very careful on what I put online. Yes, I have a Gmail account. I have a Yahoo account. But I have no pictures on there. I have no address on there. I don't even put my phone number up. So it's you have to be very careful on what you put out there. Plus, I'm a bit paranoid about pictures anyway.
Elena, I think you're alone.
And it's what you have. You have to make a choice. Granted, I have to go out in the Diane Rehn had a show about this just about 2 hours ago, so I listened to that one. When you go out, granted, you're going to be captured by the cameras, but if you don't put something for a reference up online, you know, if you don't have a Facebook account, if you don't have a picture on your Facebook account, hey, what do they have to look at?
Elena, we appreciate the phone call here, and let me put it to our commentators. I mean, gentlemen of science fiction writers, of course, have written about this, not just Orwell, but for a very long time. And there has always been kind of this this balance, or even this very real concern about government taking things a step too far.
One comment I would make: when I was in college, I was gravely concerned about a 1984 kind of future. For those that don't read science fiction, the government is monitoring you in your home. But it's the intent of the data. As we said, the fear of that society is that particular government using that tool, requiring you to, you know, stand in front of a camera every day. You know, it's a totalitarian society of which the technology didn't create that society. But the technology was used by that totalitarian government. Mm-hmm. We do not have yet a totalitarian government. And in the democracy, what we have is the ability to change this over time. And I think the surveillance is unavoidable. When you drive through an intersection, there are now cameras that are there to monitor the traffic flow, so the lights will change better without having to tear up and put coils in the road. But those pictures could be used by under proper authority to see if a stolen car had passed through that intersection. One comment I would make about people that are trying to withhold their data, remember that acting differently than the rest of the people will create a different signature, even by its absence. If you're a person that never sends a picture, if you're in person there, you could imagine somebody wondering what you're trying to hide. So this is the uncertainty problem of when people say, if you have nothing to hide, why do you care? Well, in our society, we'd like to reserve certain things unless there's a good reason for it. So the discussion of why this data should be shared and be available, I think, is still the important one.
Elena, thanks so much for the call, and have a great day.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the show.
All right. Bye-bye. 800-471-9264 is the number to call if you have a question or a comment for our panelists today. You can always email us, of course, middaymatters@nipr.fm. Post on our Facebook wall. Send us a tweet @MiddayMatters. We do need to take a quick break. Stay with us. Back in 2 minutes.
A number of tickets are now available for the Picked by the Pros Wine Dinner, Friday, June 21st at the Bergstaff Place, presented by O'Daniel Audi Porsche. Enjoy a wine tasting followed by a gourmet meal. Tickets are $125 per person or $800 for a table of eight. Purchase online at nipr.fm or call WBOI at 452-1189.
Linda Ellerbee's number one rule for talking with kids about tough topics, don't dumb it down.
Our viewers are smart people. They are merely younger, less experienced, and shorter.
I'm Neil Conan. How TV, books, art, museums, and other media help kids connect with difficult subjects. Join guest host John Donvan next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This afternoon at 2 p.m. here on WBOI.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Lake City Bank, offering a range of financial investment and trust services for individuals, businesses, and nonprofit organizations through the Lake City Bank Wealth Advisory Group. Details at lakecitybank.com.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Indiana Tech Law School, opening in Fort Wayne, August 2013. Information on admissions and curriculum online at indianatech.edu/law or 855-TECH-LAW.
It's Midday Matters Tech Tuesday on 89.1 WBOY, your home for NPR News and diverse music. I'm Sean Beter, along with Susan Burns. And Susan, we're talking big data today with some of our favorite guests.
We are. Anthony Giuliano and Bob Niskern are here to help enlighten us. And I'm thinking, Anthony, about listening to Elena, our last caller, how far we've come from the days when a marketer would send someone out to the parking lot, like at Glenbrook, to count the Ohio license plates.
Well, that still happens, too. I think one of the things that I want to go to bat for is saying that social media is not the only problem. It's not the primary problem. When I talk about the digital breadcrumbs we leave behind, it's not just the things that we conspicuously offer up, photos on Facebook or putting our birth date on Facebook. It's also purchases we make with credit cards. It's also when we sign up for loyalty cards. You know, we see the direct benefit of doing these things, and what we're doing in addition is we're giving something away in that transaction. There's a reason why these companies want to more closely understand your purchase behavior so they can deliver more relevant marketing to you. And I think we only sometimes look at this stuff as an intrusion on our privacy when the effect is conspicuously negative. But there's a lot of gray area here and a lot of things we're going to have to grapple with in the very near future.
We do want to remind our listeners, if you want to get in touch with us this hour, it's 800-471-9264. Email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm. Post on our Facebook wall or send us a tweet. It does look like we have a few more callers on the line here. So let's open the phones and go to Eric. Eric, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead,
I just wanted to kind of speak about two things real quick. The first is that medical records are being moved to digital formats, and so eventually that's all going to be available on the internet, and hopefully not freely available, obviously, but it will be digital, and it's just another thing that could be added to big data in general. And also I wanted to, more importantly, talk about anonymity. Statistics doesn't really seem to care who you are, but the people who are running the statistics may. So I think that if this big data exists, it should be anonymous at the very least, and I think it would still be very functional even if it was anonymous.
Bob, functionality versus anonymity.
Yeah, I think that's actually a very good point. Much of the marketing use of big data does not really need to know a lot more about one particular individual. You know, if you're trying to predict a pattern, you're trying to stock the shelves, do the other stuff. So, but if you are trying to target something very narrowly, let's say you're a financial broker and you really want to target down to somebody in your community that would be receptive to your message, there may be a desire to what they call drill down and take a general category, but then try to find specific examples in your area code or your zip code area. So, mm-hmm. So I think it is much of the data is quite useful just as generalized data. But as you would say on the security side, you could see where individuals the agencies would like to know the specifics. So I think the debatability here is for in these different categories, what level of data can be examined or shared down to individuals.
And I think a nuance of that too, in addition, is the size of the purchase dictates somewhat the degree to which the company will want to know about you individually. If you're talking about boxes of cereal, what Bob's saying absolutely holds, that you're looking for patterns, not individual behavior necessarily. But if you're talking about in a business-to-business setting, the purchase of huge machines or even the purchase of a car, the marketer is going to want more individualized data, and that's where some problems come in.
Right.
Yeah. And I want to toss in a couple terms that we've heard in some of the NSA reporting. There's data integration and data aggregation, and I think that's kind of what you're talking about here. Is integrating is taking from a couple sources, right? And it, sort of take us on down those definitions.
Well, a good example of integration, and I'll defer to Bob in a second, but it would be, in a simple example, would be a bank, where there are so many different touch points today, so many different digital touch points with consumers. And the end game for a bank may be understanding what is the trigger that someone decides to fill out a loan application. And there's a good chance that person's been to an ATM and seen a marketing message, that they've been on the website and seen a marketing message, they've been on their mobile phone, they've seen digital advertising. So what is the collective sum of all those interactions, and what truly collectively are the patterns that are actionable for the bank?
Yes. And Eric, we appreciate your call today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. We do have one more caller on the line I want to get to. And I also want to talk about, in a few minutes, something that Eric mentioned. I mean, there are a lot of potential seemingly universal positives that we can get to with big data as well. Let's go back to the phones here and see if Fred's on the line. Fred, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters.
Greetings. Worked with FSSA for several years, retired, then went privatization. My concern, and especially with this latest release, is that this is a private contractor employee who claims huge access to secret data. FSSA had a couple of incidents over the last 2 years where a private contractor actually misused or wrongfully accessed, for instance, food stamp information, which is private.
And you're talking about Family Social Services Administration.
Exactly. And the private contractor that now runs it. Actually, 8 contractors that runs it. And the question I have is, when and where is oversight going to be exercised? You know, we have BMV privatization, FSSA, and the recent contract situation with the ISTEP problems. It seems to me, and especially in Indiana with huge privatization pressures, that there's very little, if any, real accountability. And so often the contracts are actually written by those same contractors, so that a state employee, for instance, is very limited in terms of what they can assist. And I think the legislature is probably even more in the dark. And I just, the comments on that, I'm real concerned with privatization.
Let's put that to Bob. And Bob, you know, government, as we've discovered, has obviously a lot of access to a whole lot of information. Where do you draw that line, sharing it with private companies?
I think the caller's mention of the word oversight is what's really the most critical factor. There was no, as a small company, we have actually done work for government agencies. I believe that the general intention and policy is to not to allow a contractor inadvertent access to some master database that he could decide to use anything else he wants with. And I would say is a failure of specifications, monitoring, tracking, you know, the quality control aspect of that. That has to be a concern. These technologies are so powerful, and, you know, if somebody in the back room you're not paying attention to is making copies of the data while somebody in the front room says we have procedures in place that keep this from happening, I think that's a very legitimate question for citizens to ask about. What is the oversight? How do we know this doesn't occur? And the implication on the NSA situation is that this fellow had access to information much broader than would seem to be justified by his contracted position. That's a simple but forceful problem, in that whoever was supervising that person or how those contracts were let, that should have been an important consideration of that. And so if you have a manager at Google, for instance, that somehow had a master password and could just decide for his own private reasons that he would like to rummage through the Google database, I think Google doesn't want to see that occur either. So I think the procedures to know where the data is, to know how it's accessed, and then under what circumstances, who is allowed to access that. Those procedures should be up and down the line.
Fred, we appreciate the call. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Bye-bye. Anthony, this gets back to a point you made earlier in the program, that data, piles of data like this and the analysis that goes into them, not inherently good or evil, but as Fred and as Bob bring up, human intuition, human judgment, is the key factor in all of this.
Absolutely. There's a leadership issue here, too. You know, whether it's a governmental body, whether it's private business, it's really about the standards set about how that data will be used. And there's going to be some variance in that. There will always be variance in that. And I think it is, again, incumbent upon all of us to hold higher standards and say, as we become a more data-driven society, what kind of rules are we going to insist upon? And that goes, you know, to certainly to our elected leadership, but also where we choose to work and how we choose to lead if we're in a position to do so.
We do need to take a quick break here for the news. In the meantime, we hope you'll get in touch with us by calling 800-471-9264. You can always email us, of course, middaymatters@nipr.fm. Post on our Facebook wall. Send us a tweet @MiddayMatters. Stay with us, back in 4 minutes.
On the next Fresh Air, an untold story from World War II. Thousands of American soldiers deserted the front lines. Journalist Charles Glass says most served bravely in combat before leaving their units.
Those soldiers who fought continuously and were never rotated out of the front lines simply were under so much pressure for so long that they cracked.
Glass's book is The Deserters. Join us.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
Good afternoon. I'm Katie Anderson with WBOI News. The Indiana Supreme Court Tuesday ruled it should not get involved in a lawsuit challenging the collection of fines handed down to House Democrats during their walkouts in the 2011 and 2012 session. In a 3-2 decision, Chief Justice Bren Dixon wrote for the majority, ruling that the fines imposed by House Republicans were internal matters of the legislature and not subject to judicial review. The court ordered the fines will therefore stand. Justice Robert Rusker, in his dissent, said the legislature's discretion to punish its members does not include the discretion to withhold their pay. A group of Indiana teachers is asking School Superintendent Glenda Ritz to support National Common Core education standards. Members of the group, Stand for Children, plan to deliver a letter supporting Common Core Tuesday morning to Ritz's State House office. The state has halted implementation of the national education standards pending a review. State lawmakers signed off on a pause implementing the Common Core standards this year. They will review them this summer. The move reflected a growing backlash nationwide from conservatives who see the education standards interfering with local control of education. Governor Mike Pence announced Monday that, for the first time, Indiana will tie 2% of state agencies' budgets to a series of performance metrics. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports.
At the beginning of each fiscal year, the governor sets reversion goals for state agencies, a percentage of the money each agency receives from the state budget that's returned to state coffers at the end of the year. Agencies typically meet those goals by finding ways to cut costs or increase efficiency. For the fiscal year starting in July, state agencies can begin receiving reversion relief, reducing the percentage of their budgets they have to send back. State Budget Director Chris Atkins says agencies earn that relief by meeting or exceeding a series of benchmarks.
The governor wants to set very aggressive expectations for his agencies. He knows that he's got the personnel in place to get the job done and achieve these goals, and he expects them to stretch themselves to get it done.
The governor has set a reversion target of 3% for state agencies this coming fiscal year. Agencies can reduce that target to as low as 1% by achieving benchmarks called key performance indicators. 57% of the indicators will be new this year, while the others are carryovers from the previous administration. New indicators include lowering the infant mortality rate, a goal for the Department of Health, and increasing the total number of actual jobs created through Indiana Economic Development Corporation deals. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
Fort Wayne Museum of Art officials say it could cost more than $200,000 to repair a large steel sculpture that was knocked over by a truck that barreled across its lawn. The driver who hit the 8-to-10-ton sculpture early Sunday faces a drunken driving charge, and museum executive director Charles Shepard says repairs might take a year to complete. The sculpture, made of stainless and painted steel, was created in 1985 to commemorate Fort Wayne's industrial heritage. Shepard tells the Journal-Gazette that the museum's technical staff found the damage was too extensive to simply flip it back into place and straighten the beams. Shepard says the museum's insurance company will talk with the driver's insurance carrier about how the repair costs will be covered. Today in Fort Wayne, we can expect a high of 80 degrees and partly sunny skies. There is a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly after 4 p.m. and until about 7 p.m. This evening, we'll have partly cloudy skies and a low of 51. You're listening to Midday Matters on 89.1 WBOI, your home for NPR news and diverse music.
At 12:40 here at WBOI, I'm Sean Beter. This is Midday Matters Tech Tuesday. We're talking big data on this edition of our program, and we'd love to hear from you this hour. Call us at 800-471-9264. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm. Post on our Facebook wall or send us a tweet at Midday Matters. With us in studio, of course, Susan Burns, along with Anthony Giuliano from the Asher Agency, and Bob Niskern from Adaptive Microwear. And gentlemen, we've been talking so far kind of about what's in the news and what is big data. You know, how folks are collecting that data these days, and some of the pitfalls and gray areas. And there certainly are a whole lot of them, but there's also a lot of possibility built into these having access to these giant piles of data. And one of our callers in the last segment mentioned that Bob, maybe we can start with you, that healthcare, I mean, has huge possibilities if we can ask the right questions of these data sets. Can you talk a little bit about what's potentially on the horizon?
Yes, there's actually a pretty interesting example. There's a website out there, I think it's still active, called Foldit. But it was a use, some researchers figured out that by trial and error, you could examine some first levels of drug interactions without starting experimenting on people. You could look at drugs that had existed before, what they did, what the shape of those drugs were, the actual chemical composition. And by having that as a clue, you could look for other chemicals that had never been used in a drug setting that might have a similar shape. And you might be able to say, well, maybe we should target taking a look at these. They're similar to these others. And that's just a huge amount of sorting through a lot of data that already mm-hmm. existed. But this Foldit went further and found that by having a lot of computer power applied to it, you could actually have a computer try trial and error to see if some of these new chemicals might appear to work in a simulated setting, you know, in other words, similar to another drug reaction. And so that has generated, I understand, an enormous number of new candidates for drugs that are drugs that already existed. So we already know something about them and their side effects, but they may have new uses that we didn't anticipate. And that all came about from being able to look through all this existing data and try it in different ways.
And Anthony, I mean, when it comes to, I mean, probably our lives on the web may be the most visible, I guess, iterations of how data can make lives better. Talk a little bit about you know how regularly you know web designers, folks who had companies look at this to try to make either a shopping experience or even just a normal web experience a little bit better, because the answers theoretically are there.
Yeah, well, the goal is to make the content, whatever it is, whether it's advertising content or non-advertising content, to make it more relevant to the user. And obviously some of that it gets circular, because some of that is to deliver more relevant advertising content. But it's things like cookies. It's things like looking at patterns. How do people bounce from one website to another? What ads do they click on? What do they not click on? So again, these are things that have been going on for a long time, but it's looking at the collective experience of those digital breadcrumbs and saying, what's likely to happen when someone is delivered this certain content?
And of course, we could go on for hours and hours about this, but maybe one more example that I know we've talked with in pre-production here, Bob, lots of civic issues as well. I mean, city planning, traffic planning, all sorts of things like that have the potential to be opened up and make life better for folks. I mean, right here in Fort Wayne. Even.
Yes. You could say, if you remember years ago, you might suddenly be driving down the road and see a black cable laying across the road and a box that was counting the cars going by. Mm-hmm. Somebody had to go out, install that, put it in place for a period of time, take a survey of how many cars went through that in an attempt to monitor traffic patterns for growth around the city, how to allocate budgets for expanding which roads over the next few years. But now you can take the data from the traffic signals themselves. They collect more information than just simply, they can easily count the cars as well. And so the idea that you could look at large-scale patterns across the whole city by coordinating that and make very informed decisions to make the best use of citizens' money to give us the best relief for traffic in the future. So there's a lot of good that can come out of it.
And a lot of it is the integration of technologies. You know, with traffic, it's the integration of traffic with GPS systems. Mm-hmm. If I can have my GPS system send me in a different direction when traffic is especially congested, that's a good thing. If I can avoid that altogether, even better. Other areas where it has, you know, specific applications, weather being one of them. There's a lot of debates right now about climate change that are being made based on observation only. Why don't we gather some data and take a look at what that tells us and then make decisions based on that very large set of data, things that weren't possible before because of limited computing power now are possible.
Yeah. We want to hear from you, our listeners, of course. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about big data on this edition of our program. Call us 800-471-9264. You can always post on our Facebook page, send us a tweet at Midday Matters, or email us middaymatters@nipr.fm.
And Sean, while we're talking about callers, I see we have a caller on line one. Dan, are you there?
Yeah, I just here right now.
Great. And this is Dan Reese from Wellness Management. Have I got the name of the company right? Tell us a little bit about how you use data in your work.
Okay. Yeah, primarily what we do is we're a technology company, and we work with healthcare providers within the wellness health space. Usually it's post or pre-care within the physician or outside of physician group, work with organizations, corporations, coaching companies. And what we do is provide a system that basically can extract different types of data. We look at lab data, behavior data, assessment data, and then use that to try to make better decisions on what programs may be better options for individuals, look at those behaviors on what may have bigger impacts on what they do. And it's really a lot around the health analytics and different kind of engagement type things we're using the data for. The last 2 years, the big push has been, well, 2 or 3 years, on the mobile side, getting more data from the mobile devices, activity steps, trackers, a lot of work's coming now to the forefront in different devices on, you know, how well you sleep, blood pressure devices, a lot of at-home devices that now we're going to be able to get data for that helps us to kind of improve our data analytics and kind of the best possible information we can provide to that member, and then also help them provide better outcomes and then work with their physicians and their coaches.
Great. And Sean, I invited Dan to call in. He couldn't come to be a regular guest on the show, but I wanted our listeners to get an example of when we talk about the quantity of data that's out there, and I think you just got a taste of it. But Dan, how do you also protect this data?
That's probably our biggest, because a lot of our work's done either web-based, mobile-based, you know, browser-based, everything's moving more and more to the web piece. So our first, when we started this, security was kind of number one. Our whole design, infrastructure design, is built around how do you secure it, how do you lock it down, and then how do you share information from, like, one person to another. So the way we look at it, it's a little bit different than most. It's a one-to-one lock. So by default, we're more patient-centric. And so basically a lot of the information is it's the data of that member. And so basically they're then sharing that information. So there's all kinds of different steps we take for locking it down within our infrastructure, data encryption, localization. Everything's role-based, access-controlled. And so it's we really look at it as it's only as you need access to the data. And so we've kind of developed a process where we look at it. It's kind of like, I don't know if this makes sense, but it's a dynamic data access service. And so as you need that data, we may open that data up. Or if you need, say, a data set that's more summary basis for an organization to look at from their higher level summary, it's that data set is de-identified, given out, and then that's the data they look at. And so there's really no access given to any detailed data.
De-identified as in no names, let's say, with a given names of patients, let's say, with a given data set.
Yes. Yeah. We strip it out, we summarize it, put it into a separate data set, and then that data then is reported on, reviewed, looked at. It depends on who's, like, if you're working with a coach, there may be certain pieces of data you want to give to that coach to use. And share with them. And so we put more control into the members' hands on what they want to get access to different members that they may be interacting with.
Dan, I hope you'll stick around. We do need to take just a very short break here, and we'll continue this discussion on big data on this edition of Midday Matters. If you would like to give us a call, it's 800-471-9264. Stay with us. Back in 1 minute.
On the next Fresh Air, an untold story from World War II, thousands of American soldiers deserted the front lines. Journalist Charles Glass says most served bravely in combat before leaving their units.
Those soldiers who fought continuously and were never rotated out of the front lines simply were under so much pressure for so long that they cracked.
Glass's book is The Deserters. Join us.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
Mm-hmm. Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Reinbold and Anderson, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC. Will your money last? With a retirement plan, it can. More information on Reinbold and Anderson on the web at reinboldandanderson.com.
Eight minutes before the top of the hour, 1 o'clock, it's Midday Matters on 89.1 WBOI. I'm Sean Beter. We're talking about big data on this edition of our program. And if you have a question or comment, we'd love to hear from you this hour. 800-471-9264. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm. Post on our Facebook wall or send us a tweet at Midday Matters. We'd love to hear from you in the next few minutes. Susan Burns, fantastic experts with us this hour.
I know. We've only got a few more minutes, and we're just still scratching the surface. But we've talked about, you know, sort of where we are now. And Bob, I think you brought up a good point about where do we go from here, though?
One of the things of a lot of interest, they call it the Internet of Things. But imagine if your bridges and your roads are able to report back to the traffic department how they're doing, if that could be done inexpensively. For instance, the idea if a car drives over a pothole, the car certainly feels it. The computer in the car could actually register the shock that the car had. The GPS would know where the car was. If you shared that data on the aggregate with your community, they wouldn't have to send people out to see where the potholes are. The cars could just bring that back. So you could dramatically lower your cost of finding and prioritizing the tasks that remain. So I think that beyond just the social and the human side of it, I think a lot of the data that will be collected and used to improve the systems we depend on, infrastructure and all, I think that's very, very positive.
And of course, the issue, as we've been talking about around all of this, is disclosure, is having the choice. Should people have the choice whether or not to disclose certain data about their appliances or their lives or anything like that? But Anthony Giuliano, I mean, from what you've seen, and Dan and Bob, feel free to weigh in too. Are systems ready for this? Are we just in the nascent stages of this because we already have gigantic piles of data that we don't have time to get through? We don't have systems to be able to get through and to ask the right questions of.
I think while it has evolved, we're certainly going to see this have a greater impact and soon. The estimates about how fast big data is growing vary, but all of them say it's growing very quickly and it's going to grow to a size that we can't even conceive of right now. To your question, there's something I want to selfishly hear from Bob on. We were talking about the marketing use of big data, and one of the things I don't think marketers have yet learned how to do is how to use this information responsibly. And responsibly, I mean protecting consumer privacy, but also using it well. The big companies have a handle on this. And, you know, an example, Walmart has learned that during a hurricane, people buy Pop-Tarts, right? So what they're doing is when a hurricane is imminent, they're stocking Pop-Tarts near the hurricane supplies. But that's a company that has access to a tremendous amount of data that informs that decision. One of the things Bob and I talked about offline was all the false positives and all the irresponsible use of this data that's leading people to make bad decisions. So I'd like to hear about how you think that may evolve and become a more responsibly used tool, if you would.
I think all of us have had that feeling now. You can go to a website or you can comment on something, and then pretty soon you can detect a change in some of the ads that you're presented with. But I think we have a lesson for that from the past. If you remember the old days where you would say, I guess I got on a mailing list, that something you shared with somebody, and they said, now they're sending me all this direct mail for that. Well, that was fairly visibly. Now, the data was collected, but somebody else purchased that data in the hope that you were going to be the person that would buy their product. But if that data list was a year old, and so somebody sold it cheaper, you could long be past the point where that's even relevant to you. And we're starting to see some of that, not really abuse, but just in their enthusiasm to try to capitalize quickly on something that's known. I've done searches for products that I'm sincerely interested in. And in that day, if somebody gave me a coupon or whatever, it might have influenced my decision. Mm-hmm. But for the next 3 weeks, every website I go to and I can see echoes of that same thing happening, that's really not in any of our best interests, including the marketers. So the idea of trying to be more efficient with that and not just throw it out there and see how it sticks, I think, is an important future.
Well, one of the things that's evolving is when I began my career in marketing, it was as much an art as it was a science, and now it's becoming much more of a science. We just need better scientists. Yeah. We need analysts and people who understand data to help those who have the art responsibility to do their job a little bit better.
And Dan Reese, I want to get your voice in on this, and really to get to Anthony's point there. I mean, based on all of the data that you collect, we like to think of these systems as automated, as they snap up this data, they analyze it, they get a result, they shoot it back out. But you still need the right folks to be able to ask the right questions of those data sets.
Yeah, and I think for us, it's probably a little bit different, too, because we're really, one of our biggest concerns is around the quality of the data and the source and whether it was verified and, where we received the data from. Mm-hmm. So we get lots of data, but we do a lot around filtering and figuring out, okay, what's the best data to make the decisions on, what really makes the difference, and you really get into some statistical analysis on what data sets to use, what we throw out, what's noise. And so for us, especially around health, you've got to be really careful on, getting not too much data, but getting the right data. And so I think that is going to progress over time. There's also, we differentiate between what may be consumer data. There's some interesting things we played around with where, like, say, for around nutrition, I could, with a mobile app, tell, hey, you're at a fast food restaurant. Well, you might want to make a better choice right now. And so the user has the ability to say, notify me or not. And so that's a good way of looking at like GPS data to know, kind of back to your pothole analysis. It's a similar thing for a consumer side for us. But that has a different level of weight than we would look at, say, that if we have a blood lab and we know your glucose level or something like that, that there's other information we use that for coaching. That and we just look at the data differently depending on the types of analysis we're doing at the time. So
we only have a few seconds, about 60 seconds left here to wrap up. And Bob, I want to give you the last word here on what you see going forward in terms of how fast you see this analysis continuing to scale up. Your vision for the future in 30 seconds or less.
I think it is going to continue to scale. It's going to increase at an enormous rate, and I think Anthony's point actually is the most valuable. There are whole new careers to be created. I think loosely there's one called data scientists now, which you can actually receive training in responsible ways to use the data and the links. And so I'm very optimistic, actually, that the human side of management of this can rise to this. And I think citizens have to just be aware and understand that those issues of dependency that they can have a say on, they have a right to make their comments.
That's unfortunately all the time we have today. I know we could do 10 more shows on this, but yeah. Big thanks to Anthony Giuliano from the Asher Agency, Bob Niskern from Adaptive Microware, and Dan Reese from Wellness Management. Gentlemen, thank you all for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Susan Burns, thank you very much for being with us. Thanks to our listeners. I'm Sean Beter, and this is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, WBOY Fort Wayne. It's 1 o'clock. From the